Good morning. So, I grew up in a community on Long Island that was. I grew up in a community on Long Island that was really ravaged by Hurricane Sandy. And in the weeks after the storm, I ended up, really all of us that grew up in that community, sort of connected over the phone. And we were talking and we were speaking, you know, all the various sort of reactions to a storm like that. And we were speaking about our parents' homes and fixtures of our childhood. And then inevitably the conversation would always turn to the shul. And I found it interesting that no matter who I spoke to, and this was sort of, and I spoke with my friends and my siblings about this afterwards, and they said they actually had the same experience. When we spoke about our homes, when we spoke about our parents, when we spoke about places that we had spent years growing up in, and the condition that those places and those buildings were in, we were very sad. We were sad and we felt, you feel vulnerable and you feel sad that you can't help out more and that you can't do things differently. When the conversation turned to our shul, and we spoke about the shul and the Sidurim and the Machzorim that had been piled up on tables right outside on the front lawn, and the Sifrei Torah that had been salvaged and just were literally piled up on tables, that experience was horrifying. It was very different than the sadness we experienced when we saw the other buildings. And I was struck by that. I was struck, and again, this wasn't just my experience. I think, you know, everyone who I spoke to really said that this was what they felt when the conversations went on. And I was struck by this, and I was struck by the dissonance between the two experiences. And it got me thinking about the topic of space, and particularly sacred space, and how we as Jews react to and interact with sacred space, what makes a space sacred, what makes a space holy. Have those qualifications remained constant over the millennia, or have they evolved and changed over the course of our history? And in order really to answer this question, I think we have to go back to the beginning. We're going to be spending, next week we're going to be celebrating Pesach, and of course we know that following the Exodus, following Yetziat Mitzrayim, B'nai Israel spent 40 years, a protracted period of wandering in the Midbar, and anyone who's ever read any of those stories in Shmot and Bamidbar knows that it's not a flattering picture of our early years. It's filled with strife and complaint. Only days after Hashem took us through Yam Suf, we were longing already for Egypt. We said, "B'shivteinu al shir habasar b'ochleinu lechem lasova." And then again, throughout those 40 years, there was this sense of doubt, this sense of wondering, where is God? Can God be found amongst us? And of course, the 40 years was a period in which ostensibly we reached a heightened level of what you might call either collective, either emotional, psychological, or religious maturity, ready to enter the land and take over Eretz Canaan. So if you were to ask any child above the age of 3 that's had any form of day school education or been to Shabbos groups even once in their lives, where is Hashem? What will they tell you? Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Up, up, down, down, right? And we all know the song, and the truth is, all joking aside, we actually owe tremendous debt to Uncle Moishe for that, because he really does simplify a very complex topic, and kids just grow up really sort of internalizing those words, and it's just this song that they sing relatively flippantly, but unequivocally. I think that when we think about God, we live in a post-modern, post-rationalistic age, and I think that many of us may think about God, and we may think about him often, and we may wrestle with the concept of God, but for the most part, those struggles really take place on the abstract plane. We may wonder about divine providence and how much God is actually involved in our daily affairs. At any point in a person's life, they will eventually come to wrestle with the topic of tzaddik v'ra'lo, of the idea of why God either allows, at the very least, or why God perhaps makes innocent people or righteous people suffer. But for the most part, when we think of God in time, right? And the organizing principle, or the lens through which we view our history, is a series of divine human encounters. Times in our history in which God encountered us initiated a relationship with us, interacted with the human realm. And of course, because our calendar is a cyclical one, on an annual basis, we commemorate, we memorialize, we relive those divine human encounters. And of course, every single person in this room next Monday night is going to be celebrating, commemorating, and reliving one of the climaxes of our history, Yetziat Mitzrayim. When we think about ancient man, when we talk about man in the ancient world, what we have to realize is that the preoccupation of man in the ancient world was not when God was in history, not even specifically how God is in history, but where God could be found. It was a preoccupation on the minds of ancient man, and it was really understanding where God is, where God could be located, where his divine presence could be found, was really, for all intents and purposes, a precondition to worship. And when I speak about ancient man, by the way, I want to be clear on this. I am implicitly including B'nai Israel and ancient Israel in this larger grouping, because although the Torah refined and sort of redefined much of theology and worldview and ideology, what we have to remember is that Am Yisrael, certainly the people that were standing at the foot of Har Sinai, but even beyond that, were influenced and their thought was shaped by the surrounding cultures, by their neighbors. And we know that the Torah goes out of its way to try to define where God is and define what God is for us, but for all intents and purposes, and this is really evidenced by the centuries worth of prophetic critique, the Nevi'im Achronim constantly trying to realign what the nation of Israel thought with what was understood to be an authentic form of monotheistic worship. And so when we speak about the sort of preoccupations of ancient man, we have to understand that these concepts and these ideas were things that really majority of the nation of Am Yisrael struggled with as well. When we speak about, and by the way, when the sort of line that's thrown out very often, Dibra Torah Kilshon B'nai Adam, we say that the Torah speaks in the language of man. That's really, really speaking specifically to this issue. It's not saying only that the Torah is written in the Hebrew language, and it's not even limited to the idioms and the phrases that are used in the Torah. When we say Dibra Torah Kilshon B'nai Adam, or alternatively we say Diber HaKatuv Behoveh, what we're really speaking about is the way in which Hashem accommodated himself or adjusted his revelation for the needs of the people, so that the people who accepted and who received the Torah, and then later on, of course, the Nevi'im did the same thing, can understand and internalize those ideas based on the preconceived notions and assumptions that they were coming in with. In retrospect, I think when we talk about the generation of the desert, the generation that experienced Yetziat Mitzrayim and then the generation that followed, it's very easy to criticize and it's very easy to question how a people that had seen all of the miracles and all of the plagues and Kriyat Yam Suf could question as they did and could doubt as they did. But I think that in order to really appreciate the full scope of the narrative, we have to appreciate the landscape of the desert, of the wilderness. And I use the word landscape and not just simply topography, because landscape really has a very specific connotation. Landscape speaks to the interaction between human beings and their environment, right? What the geography evokes in the people that are looking out at it. So for example, if I were to take a farmer and a real estate mogul and have them stand and gaze out at an uncultivated parcel of land, those two people would have very different reactions to what they were looking at. Because there's one piece of land or one space in that picture, but two very different landscapes. When we speak about the wilderness, when we speak about the desert, and remembering, bearing in mind that Israel was an ancient-minded people, we have to realize that the wilderness was a very, very frightening place for man. If someone today would think about getting lost in the desert, that would be a very scary thought, right? We would worry about the elements, we would worry about the animals, we would probably worry that we wouldn't have cell phone service, which would be my first thought. But those are relatively, I would say, innocuous things to worry about compared to what ancient man thought about. The desert, the wilderness, was associated in the mythology of the ancient world with the beings of the netherworld, with these uncontrollable, chaotic forces. Really, it was associated really more closely with the primordial world than it was with the habitable, cultivated, civilized world where man lived. There were numerous myths from the ancient world about the beings of the netherworld coming up, surfacing, and vanquishing the gods of fertility and goodness, and really rendering, leaving the world in this chaotic shape for a degree of time. And so the myths, and of course we know that myths are really reflective of the anxieties and the concerns of ancient man, but these myths really spoke to the fears and the concerns that ancient man had with the desert. Because if you think about it, the desert is really a place betwixt and between. Right? It doesn't really belong to any one culture, any one civilization. There's really no order and no system in the desert that man feels comfortable with, particularly for Am Yisrael. Okay? And even if you think about the narratives that describe our wanderings in the desert, when we were in the Midbar, right, we didn't yet own land in Eretz Yisrael, but we weren't anymore owned by the land of Mitzrayim. If you think about the fecundity in Egypt, we talk about Paru, Vayishutsu, Vayirbu, and we speak about all of the reproductive capabilities in Mitzrayim. And then, of course, Hashem promises Eretz Zavat Chalav U'Devash, He promises the fertility of the land of Canaan. Interestingly, throughout the 40 years in the Midbar, not one birth is recorded. It was really literally no man's land, both spatially, temporally. Nothing necessarily happened in terms of movement, in terms of movement towards Canaan. There was literally this feeling of just wandering in circles. And of course, the narrative speaks to, or at least reflects, that notion of just sort of living betwixt and between. And so the feelings or the experiences of vulnerability and chaos were at a peak in the mind of Israel. By the way, in Tanakh also, if you even think about it, in terms of Midbar and where Midbar surfaces, you never see a person going to the Midbar, l'chatchila, so to speak. The only people that ever go to the Midbar are fleeing to the Midbar. So you have David HaMelech fleeing when he's running away from Shaul. You have Eliyahu HaNavi fleeing from Izebel. The only time people go to the Midbar, and again, this is consistent with the portrait we have of it, is when the sort of unknown dangers of the Midbar are preferable to the known dangers of the civilized, cultivated world. And so the Midbar really consistently, both in the narrative portions and also in the poetic portions of Tanakh, if you look, for example, in Sefer Tehillim, the Midbar really maintains these scary connotations and associations. That being said, it really doesn't come as a surprise that one of the questions that was on the forefront of the minds of the people in Israel is the very famous question that they ask very soon after Kriyat Yam Suf, as we mentioned. They say, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu imayin. Right? Is Hashem in our midst? And while we may understand that metaphorically, Bnei Yisrael meant it in a very concrete way. Is Hashem literally in our midst in the Midbar? In this wilderness, in this unpredictable, unregimented world or existence that we are now living in the Midbar, can God be found? Can God be located? Can God be approached so that we can approach Him, we can come close to Him, and we can worship Him? And by the way, coming on the heels of what Hashem said during the Makot, L'ma'an teda ki ani Hashem b'kerev ha'aretz, this question, while perhaps problematic, it's not inexplicable. Okay? Bearing in mind what the wilderness meant, bearing in mind how ancient man conceived of God and God in space, the question is actually a very, very fair, very understandable question. The Midbar really was, in many ways, a journey. And we speak about the Midbar and the 40 years that they spent in the Midbar. But the Midbar, importantly, was not only betwixt and between, but it was a cultural vacuum. Okay? And it created a space in which something new can be introduced to the world. And so in the midst of all of this uncertainty, and all of this disorientation, and all of this fear and anxiety wrought by the realities of the Midbar, Hashem created a barrier to the chaos, or almost what you might call an antidote to the uncertainty. And if you look in your sources on page 1, we see that only a few weeks after Yitziat Mitzrayim, Hashem brings Bnei Yisrael to the mountain, to Har Sinai. Begins in Pasuk Aleph, Bachodesh HaShlishi, Litzait Bnei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Bayom Hazeh, Ba'u Midbar Sinai. They came to the Midbar Sinai. Vayesu Me'refidim, Vayabau Midbar Sinai, Vayachanu Ba Midbar, Vayichan Sham Yisrael, Neged Ha'har. They left from Rephidim. They got to this localized area, Midbar Sinai, and they encamped there opposite this har. Umoshe Allah el ha'elokim vayikra elav Hashem min ha'har lemor, kotomar levet Yaakov v'tageid levinei Yisrael. And Hashem from that mountain calls out to Moshe, and he begins to prescribe the way in which Am Yisrael is now going to live from here on in. And he invites them into a covenant. He cuts a covenant with them, literally. And it says in Pasuk Hey, Ve'ata im shamoa tishmu bekoli u'shmartem et briti, v'yitem li skula mikol ha'amim, ki li kol ha'aretz. He introduces, really, to this nation that up until now had been not only sort of persecuted, but really disenfranchised in many ways. He creates for them a means by which they can create order out of the disorder. And he prescribes for them a means by which they can carve out for themselves a very powerful niche in this world. He goes on and he says, "Va'atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh ele hadvarim asher tedaber el b'nei Yisrael." And then Moshe goes on and he repeats, or he sort of transcribes for Am Yisrael exactly what Hashem said. It's very interesting. We mentioned that the desert had very specific connotations. The landscape of the desert had very specific connotations for ancient man. The same really goes for the mountain. And once again, by Hashem appearing on Har Sinai, we see the same concept of Hashem midaber kilshon b'nei Adam, of Hashem speaking based on the preconceived notions of man. The mountain in the ancient world was actually, or more specifically, the cosmic mountain, was one of the most ubiquitous symbols in the ancient world. And mountains were really understood to be the nexus between heavens and earth. They were really understood to be the place where the human and the divine realm connect, or where the gods can appear to man. And it doesn't really take a wild imagination to understand why these large, imposing mountains with their tips converging with the clouds and heavens would be understood as the place where those barriers would be breached. And by the way, the ziggurats of ancient Babylon really were man-made mountains, essentially, where there were only plateaus. They had to create their own mountains, their own places where the heavens, where the divine could be reached. And of course, oversimplifying these sort of nuanced mythical traditions, but the symbol of the mountain was very, very widespread and consistent throughout cultures. What Hashem enabled Am Yisrael to do at Har Sinai, Hashem created a space in the Midbar, in response to this question, Hayesh Hashem bekirbenu im ayin, and he responded in the affirmative, and he created a space in the Midbar that man implicitly understood as a place where the gods and the humans can interact. And he, upon that mountain, he presented this covenant, these Aseret Hadibrot and the Torah that followed. Now, it's very interesting. If you think about Har Sinai, Har Sinai is probably the most important event that happened in our entire history. And yet, it doesn't take up a lot of space in the rest of the Torah, or Nach at all. Okay? What do I mean by this? There's a search tool on Google called Get Cited that you probably know about, which is basically anyone who's ever published anything can check how many times their work has been cited in footnotes by other authors. Okay? Lahavdil, obviously. But when we talk about inner biblical allusions, right, we talk about the way in which later works of Tanakh draw from or allude to earlier events, earlier personalities, earlier places. And those allusions really speak to the prominence of that, again, event, person, place, in the collective mindset of Israel. Okay, so just by way of example, if you think about the way that Yeshayahu depicts Acharit Hayamim, and he sort of, he communicates to the people what they can expect at the end of days. He draws from the imagery of Yitziat Mitzrayim and the movement from Mitzrayim through the Midbar back to Eretz Yisrael. Not coincidentally, by the way, in the very beginning of Sefer Ezra Nehemiah, when Ezra Nehemiah are trying to drive home the import of the event that B'nai Yisrael were witnessing, as Cyrus, if you remember, in 539 BCE, Cyrus allowed B'nai Yisrael to return to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, and in an effort to drive home the import of that event, the author of Ezra Nehemiah also culled from some of the images and some of the motifs that we see in the period of Yitziat Mitzrayim and beyond. Okay? We didn't, it sort of should be still fresh in your mind, so I'll go back to Megillat Esther just very quickly. One of the things that the author of Megillat Esther does is draw consistently from the episode of Yosef in Mitzrayim, because Yosef was the prototype, the very first Jew living in a foreign court, successfully strategizing his loyalty to his father's home and to what you might call loosely religion, and the loyalty to the throne and his ability really to sort of synthesize loyalties to those two realms simultaneously. And so one of the things, though, that we have to realize, of course, is that those allusions or echoes of those earlier events or personalities are only effective and are only drawn from as long as the prototypes still remain a sort of prominent feature in the collective mindset of Israel. Okay. That being said, what we have to wonder is, we think of Matan Torah as the be-all and end-all. Okay. With the exception of two places in Tanakh, Har Sinai is not really mentioned again at all. Okay. Har Sinai is mentioned once in Shirat Devorah, where Shirat in Perek Hay in Sefer Shoftim, where she says, excuse me, Harim Nazlu Mipnei Hashem, Ze Sinai Mipnei Hashem. She refers to it in part of her song, but even in that case where she's referring to the God of Sinai, that Hashem, which she's depicting really there, is a warrior God. And by the way, that pasuk is resurfaces again in Sefer Tehillim in Perek Samachet, a similar formulation of this Har, of this God of Sinai, but again being presented as a warrior God. Okay? The image or the perception of this God, this utopian God, as suddenly appearing and becoming imminent and locative on this one specific mountain for a given time and bridging that gap between the divine and the human realm and presenting himself as locatable and locative in a specific place for the sake of the people on Har Sinai does not seem to be recollected or drawn from at later portions in Tanakh. And that's a serious question. But I think that in order to really even ask that question, we are falling prey to what's known as genetic fallacy, or alternatively what's known as the fallacy of origins. Okay, genetic fallacy basically means, or is basically when you misrepresent something by looking at its origins, by looking at what it was at its earliest inception, in its earliest phases, without really following through and seeing how that phenomenon evolved and changed over the course of history. Okay, so I'll give an example, just something I guess from our times that we can relate to. You think about, imagine a hypothetical scenario where a person from another country comes to New York City and a tour guide takes them on a tour of Lower Manhattan and says, this is where the World Trade Center once stood. These were the Twin Towers. These are where, you know, the shadows of where the Twin Towers once were. And the tour guide will tell the person all about their construction in the 1970s and speak about their role in New York City history throughout the end of the 20th century, but stop before the events of September 11th. Okay? That would be a perfect example of genetic fallacy, because you're misrepresenting something really important by only focusing on a splice of something's early history without dealing with or speaking about other elements that are so central to the legacy of that phenomenon or of that place or of that event. Okay? When we speak about the episode at Har Sinai, I think that we lose sight of things, or we fall prey to this genetic fallacy when we ask why the name Har Sinai is not repeated again, without looking carefully at the experience of Har Sinai and how perhaps that experience was then transposed at other portions in our history. If you just look back for one second at your sources, we see that Hashem says that he's going to appear to Am Yisrael. And he says in Pasuk Tet, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, back in Perek Yitet, Hinei Anochi Ba'i Lecha Be'av Ha'anan, Ba'avor Yishma Ha'am, B'dabri Imach, V'gam B'cha Ya'aminu Le'olam, V'yaged Moshe Divrei Ha'am El Hashem. Hashem says he's going to appear in this very thick cloud. And what's very interesting, if you look a little bit further down, we speak a lot about mila mancha. We speak about words that sort of appear and reappear consistently throughout an episode to give us one of the things that a mila mancha does is sort of cue us into one of the central elements of that specific narrative. If you look, for example, in Pasuk Yud, that you see the first example of this mila mancha. Hashem tells Bnei Yisrael to prepare 3 days appropriately for what they're about to experience. And then he goes on and says, V'higbalta et ha'am saviv lemor. Hishamru lachem alot bahar, ungoa bekatzehu kol hanogea bahar mot yumat. Okay? Hashem warns them to create barriers or create these boundaries around the mountain, lest they come too close to the mountain and die. Okay? And it goes on, and Hashem says this over and over throughout the episode. He goes on in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Lo tigabo ki yad sakol yisakel o yaro yireh, im behema im ish lo yichyeh. And he goes on, he says, it's not, regardless of whether the person is male, female, animal, anyone who comes too close to this mountain, when God's presence will be there, will suffer the fatal consequences. Go down a little bit, Pasuk. If you jump to Pasuk Chafalef, Hashem warns them again. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Reid ha'ed ba'am pen yersu el Hashem lir'ot v'nafal mimenu rav. Hashem reminds them again, Moshe, tell them not to forget, don't come too close, don't push past these boundaries that are going to be erected. The gam ha'goan kohanim ha'nigashim el Hashem yitzkadashu pen yifrotz ba'hem Hashem. And one of the things we get from this repetition over and over of creating and maintaining and being wary of these boundaries is this very vivid sense that if they were not reminded, that they might almost have this proclivity to sort of burst forth or to jump into whatever it was that this presence of Hashem was upon the Har. And so we get this sense that man left to his own devices has this penchant to jump into literally the presence of Hashem on the mountain. Now, I apologize because this source was actually cut off, and that's my fault, but if you were to jump to the very next perek, in Sefer Shemot, what you have in Pasuk Yedalin in Perek Chaf is the very famous Pasuk we know, where Bnei Yisrael Hashem gives the Aseret HaDibrot, and then Bnei Yisrael say, Daber Atah, they say to Moshe Rabbeinu, they say, Daber Atah Imanu V'nishma'a, V'al Yedaber Imanu Elokim Pen Namut. After we see, it's at least the way it appears in the Torah, after Hashem gives the Aseret HaDibrot, Bnei Yisrael beg Moshe, and they say, Moshe, please, we can't hear Hashem's voice. We're scared we're going to die. Please, Moshe, be the sort of intermediary between us and God. And so what we see here in the cumulative effect of these two prakim is this sort of cross, or what appears almost as a paradox or dichotomy between sort of fascination and fear, between what you might call awe and at the same time this desire to come closer. And not only do we see these two opposing, perhaps, proclivities, but what we also get a very, very vivid sense of is Hashem responding to those two opposing experiences with a very clearly regimented, controlled means by which the human being standing at the foot of Har Sinai can both bask in the presence of God, but do it in a safe way, from a safe distance. And of course, as we know, the different strata of Israel were granted different degrees of closeness, of proximity to Hashem. And so Moshe went the highest. Aharon was allowed further access without being as close as Moshe. And of course, as you go down in the hierarchy of Am Yisrael, the sort of this chain ensued, with the Kohanim being lower down and Am Yisrael standing at the foot of the mountain. I think that if we go back now and we think about the way in which the presence of God was attracted and maintained on Har Sinai, where this, as we speak about this, imminent God was located at a specific time in a specific place, and then a very careful system of rules and regulations whereby people had to be purified and had to maintain an appropriate distance from the varying degrees of holiness associated with that place. Then if we go back to this question of genetic fallacy and we think about the potential pitfalls of it, when we ask why Har Sinai is not mentioned again, we're really losing sight of the fact that the Beit HaMikdash built by Shlomo, not coincidentally on a mountaintop in Yerushalayim, is actually really, if you think about it, the organic extension of that one-time experience in the Midbar. Because just like the Har, there is a system, there is purification prior to the closeness. God is brought into the Beit HaMikdash, and of course there's the various strata within Israel are granted various degrees of proximity. If you go back to your source sheets, source 2 very quickly, it's not surprising that the very first thing that Shlomo HaMelech does after years, literally spending years constructing and furnishing the Beit HaMikdash, the very first thing he does in Pasuk Gimel in Perek Ched, it says, "Vayavou kol zikne Yisrael, vayisu hakohanim et ha'aron." Once the Beit HaMikdash was finished, once the physical building itself was built, the very first thing Shlomo HaMelech does is bring the Aron in to the Beit HaMikdash. Pasuk Dalet, "Vayalu et Aron Hashem, ve'et ohel moed, ve'et kol klei hakodesh asher ba'ohel, vayalu otam hakohanim v'halivim." And they bring not only the Aron, but all of the various kelim from the Ohel Moed. Ve'hamelech Shlomo v'chol adat Yisrael hanoadim alav ito lifnei ha'aron mizabchim tzon uvakar asher lo yisapru v'lo yimanu meiro. And they're bringing this infinite amount of sacrifices. Pasuk Vav. Vayaviu hakohanim et Aron brit Hashem el mikomo el dvir habayit el kodesh hakodashim el tachat kanfei hakruvim. And then this is really the final stage in the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, is the placement of Aron Brit Hashem into the Devir, into the Kodesh Kodashim. And of course, as we know, if you jump down to Pasuk Yud, Vayihi B'tzeit HaKohanim min HaKodesh. As soon as the Kohanim left the Kodesh and the Aron had been firmly planted in its appropriate place, the He'anan, that very same thick cloud, Malei et Beit Hashem. Once again, that very same cloud that we saw on Har Sinai now fills Beit Hashem. And now, once again, now that the Divine Presence has been invited in, or the Divine Presence has come, Lo yachlu ha-kohanim la'amod l'sharet mipnei He'anan, ki Malei kvod Hashem et Beit Hashem. Okay? Just like Har Sinai, the day before Hashem appeared, was just an ordinary mountain and anyone could have gone up. Once the presence of Hashem rested there, it became a mountain that was intangible, that no one, right, lest they die, could approach. So too the Beit HaMikdash. As Amar Shlomo, Hashem Amar Lishkon Ba'arafel. And Shlomo speaks now about Hashem as residing or resting in this thick cloud. And he says the very famous words, Bano Baniti Beit Zvul Lach Machon L'Shiftecha Olamim. Essentially concretizing what we know to be the reality, which is that for the entire history, really, of biblical Israel, the Beit HaMikdash remains the preeminent fixture in our history. And again, to various degrees, depending geographically where people lived, but there's no question that the Beit HaMikdash was understood consistently from the Chanukat HaMikdash in the days of Shlomo, until its destruction in 586 by the Babylonians. The Beit HaMikdash was understood to be the place where God's presence was located, again, based on the needs of ancient man, where God could be found, and where God could be approached, and sacrifices could be brought, and God could be worshipped. Okay? The problem is that the Beit HaMikdash didn't last forever. And as we mentioned, in 586, the Babylonians came in and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. And the potential, really, catastrophe that came with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash was that here you had a group of people that for hundreds of years had been worshiping God in one way, that now had to rethink and recalibrate and try to come up with a way to worship God in the absence of that hallowed space, in the absence of that Mikdash that again had really functioned as the fixture of religion for all of those centuries. And very interestingly, actually, ironically, it was the very words of the Nevi'im that had been warning about the Khorban in the decades prior to the Khorban that preempted what you might say really could have been the end to biblical Judaism, if you think about it. if you just allow me to backtrack just for a couple of minutes, Yirmiyahu HaNavi, among, and I'm going to quote Yirmiyahu just because he's sort of the most prominent of the Nevi'im that spoke about these ideas, but really most of the Nevi'im that spoke to the inhabitants of Judah, of Malchut Yehuda, prior to the Korban, spoke about the inflated sense of security in the Beit HaMikdash and in the inviolability of the Beit HaMikdash, specifically because Hashem was believed to dwell there. And it was almost as if to say the people came to believe that the Beit HaMikdash could never be destroyed. Hashem resided there, and so it was untouchable. And one of the things that the Nevi'im had to consistently warn the people about over and over was not to place all of your faith in the Mikdash the way that they were doing. It's actually very interesting because this sort of, as I mentioned, inflated sense of the permanence of the Beit HaMikdash was only exacerbated after the destruction of the temples in the north. If you remember when the 10 tribes were exiled, their temples were destroyed by the Assyrians in 722. And then in 701, if you recall, in the days of Chizkiyahu, the Assyrians laid siege around Yerushalayim, and they were about to destroy Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash as well. But in the 11th hour, miraculously, and the story is told both in Malachim and in Yeshayahu, miraculously in the 11th hour, the Assyrian camp army died, and they weren't able to attack, and so Yerushalayim was freed. And so that only reinforced, as I mentioned, this sort of false sense of security in the building and in the cult and cultic worship. What Yirmiyahu essentially did, I'll just backtrack one more step. If you look at the very first page of your sources, you have a picture here. It's a relief. It's an Assyrian relief. It was found in an Assyrian temple. And what it depicts really was, as I mentioned, the prevalent view in the ancient world, which was when a temple is destroyed, because, and again, sort of follow the chain of logic here, if gods resided in temples, then if a temple is destroyed, then essentially what that meant is that god had been defeated. And what you have here is a depiction of Assyrians carrying out the enemy gods from one of the temples they had destroyed. And again, we may understand this symbolically. It was very concrete to the ancient-minded person who was worshiping in the temple and believed that the gods could be found in that specific building. Okay. When the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, B'nai Israel could have very easily jumped to the conclusion, that would not have been such a tremendous jump, again, based on the associations that they had, that Hashem, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the God of Israel, had been defeated by the Babylonians, by Marduk, whatever the case may be. Specifically because Yirmiyahu had foretold about the Korban and had warned them that the Korban is coming and that Hashem is angry at Am Yisrael and he is going to send the Mitzafon Tipatach Hara, he's going to send punishment from the north and give Shabbat for the land. Specifically because he warns about the Korban, when it finally happened, rather than assuming that God had been defeated, B'nai Israel were able to understand that the destruction was not a defeat of God, but was part and parcel of God's mission and God's plan for the world unfolding in history. And so Yirmiyahu really enabled them to not only understand the Korban and make sense of the destruction, he then also offered them a two-pronged approach to survival in the Galut. If you look to your sources, source 3, we see Yirmiyahu really giving them all of the answers they need for survival. In Perek Chavtet, if you start with Pasuk Dalet, for example, Yirmiyahu says, and he really, again, he sort of preempts this or introduces this by saying Hashem is planning the exile, it's going to happen. Pasuk Dalet, Ko amar Hashem tzvakot Elokei Yisrael, l'chol hagolah asher higleti mirshalayim bavela. Okay? God intentionally exiled these people. It is not a defeat of God. If anything, it is a verification of God's power in this world. Banu batim v'shevu v'nit'u ganot v'ichlu et piryan. And now he essentially prescribes for the people a recipe for survival in Galut. And the first prong of this approach is to survive physically. You should build houses, you should cultivate the land, you should cultivate vineyards. Chuna shim v'holidu banimu v'anot v'chul ibnechem nashim v'vnotechem tnu la'anashim. Take wives for your sons and marry your daughters off. V'teladna banimu v'anot urevusham v'al timatu. The first thing Yirmiyahu says is that in order to survive in Galut, you need to live. Okay? And that's the physical survival.
If you jump down, Yirmiyahu also offers something else. And this goes back to what we were saying about that vacuum created when the temple was destroyed. Because surviving physically is one thing, but conceiving of a God that can no longer be found in one place. Even if you believe that God hadn't been defeated, the question is, well, then how do I approach him? How do I find God? How do I locate God? The very same question that Bnei Israel asked way back in the Midbar, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu amayin, is going to be reverberating in their ears now in the wake of the destruction. And so if you jump down to Pasuk Yud Aleph, down to Pasuk Yud Bet, Ukratem oti v'halachtem v'tpalaltem elai v'shamati aleichem. Hashem says, all you have to do, and I'm paraphrasing here, is call out to me and pray for me and pray to me and search for me, and I will hear you. Uvikashtem oti umitzatem ki tidrashuni b'chol levavchem. Search for me with all your hearts. Again, I'm paraphrasing. Yirmiyahu says, and you will find me. V'nimtzeiti lachem ne'um Hashem, v'shavti asher etchem, v'kibatzti etchem mikol hagoyim u'mikol hamikomot asher hidachti etchem sham ne'um Hashem, v'hashivoti etchem el hamakom asher higleiti etchem misham. Yirmiyahu makes very clear to the people that during this window of Galut in Babel, they can survive, and not only can they survive physically, but they can survive spiritually because all they have to do is search for Hashem in their hearts, and Hashem will be found and Hashem will be there with them. And so Yirmiyahu really redefines in many ways, or sort of, if you might say, eclipses this temple-centric theology and creates a new reality for the people, redefines where God could be found. God is not limited to the temple. God is not confined to the temple or concentrated specifically in the temple. God could be found literally wherever you search for him. And that was very powerful and that was very important. And as we know, Galut Babel ultimately ended. And this sort of refinement of an earlier theology really made its way into the period of Bayit Sheni. And I'm not going to be doing justice at all to the period of Bayit Sheni, but just very loosely, if you think about it, I'm going to define it this way. If you think about the first temple, okay, Bayit Rishon, as this vertical image where the Beit HaMikdash was conceived of as the only place where Hashem can be found or where Hashem can be worshipped. And then you think about Galut Babel and this, as I mentioned, this refinement of theology. Then the second temple period we have to imagine on a more horizontal plane. And what I mean by that is that majority of the Jews during Bayit Sheni really lived in the diaspora. It was actually only a minority, definitely in the early years of Bayit Sheni, that people were actually living in Yerushalayim and actually had daily access to the Mikdash. Majority of the Jews were living either in Babel or down in Mitzrayim, in Elephantine we're going to mention in a couple of minutes. But because the Beit HaMikdash was what it was, it really remains the focal point or the fixture, even for the Jews that were living in the lands beyond Eretz Yisrael. And it really was the, remained, for all intents and purposes, this definitive outlet, this focal point for religious worship, even for people who weren't able to worship there in person. And I'll just give you an example, only because it's right before Pesach, so I think it's a great Inyan Idioma issue. If you look on the last page of your sources, during the Persian period, there was actually a Jewish temple. It's not necessarily so well known. There was actually a Jewish temple on the island of Elephantine, which is just by the Nile River, which is now southern Egypt. And whether or not it was just monotheistic or perhaps syncretistic with some of the Egyptian gods is something that scholars debate and deal with. But the temple at Elephantine actually had Kohanim, or what they understood to be priests, Kohanim. And what you have here is actually the remnants of a papyrus that was found that evidences correspondence between the priests in the Elephantine Temple and the Kohanim in Yerushalayim. And what you see here are the priests questioning the Kohanim in Yerushalayim, asking them about the proper worship and when the festival of Pesach starts and exactly what should be kept and what should be maintained and how to go about keeping a proper Pesach. And so, again, this is perhaps more of an extreme example, but we have a very vivid sense of the fact that the Beit HaMikdash, even though the concept of God being found anywhere and internalized did exist in a rough degree, that the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim really remained the pivot around which all of Judaism during the period of Bayit Sheni revolved. And it was the center, and it was the centralizing force, really. It almost exerted, if you think about it, this centripetal force that maintained a unity among all of the different Jews throughout the diaspora. For that reason, really, the watershed came with the destruction of Bayit Sheni. Because whereas people understood, based on the words of the Nevi'im, of Yishayahu, of Yirmiyahu, that the Chorban Bayit Rishon and the exile that would ensue would be a transient one, Chazal very quickly understood the leaders after the destruction of Bayit Sheni, and particularly after the defeat of Bar Kokhba in the 130s, understood all too well that the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash was going to be, that we were in it really for the long haul, and that this was not a temporary, ephemeral galut like the first one had been. And what they really had to contend with, if you think about it, in light of how we understood Bayit Sheni, is they had to contend with the possibility, the potential, for a centerless religion. They had to think about what that would be if the center was now gone. And how do you create, essentially, what Chazal really, in their inimitable fashion, thought about and conceived of, was a means by which to create centering structures within the daily, mundane religion of Israel. Okay? And so, again, I'm not doing justice to this topic at all, but just some examples that I think many of us are familiar with. We talk about two people sitting at a table exchanging Divrei Torah, and it says the Shekhinah is Shorah Beinehem, that the Shekhinah can be found there. Or someone who sits at a table and follows the proper religious etiquette of eating and reciting the brachot and the proper respect that should be granted the act of eating at a table, so too God's presence can be found anytime someone recites the Shema, etc., etc. And so what Chazal really created were centering structures within our daily lives that can be created by people wherever they were. And in that way, they were able to maintain the continuity of religion because the center wasn't lost, it was just dissipated. The one question really, though, that we have to think about, and this is the final question that we're going to end with, really, is Chazal really one of the hallmarks when we talk about rabbinic Judaism, right? What we roughly call Chazal. One of the hallmarks, one of the really cornerstones of their worldview and of their thought and of their way of conceiving of anything that they put forth, be it a new halakha, be it a new concept, or in this case, a fully fleshed out worldview, is that nothing they were doing was innovative, nothing they were doing was brand new, and nothing was just this sort of spontaneous concept that they came up with out of nowhere. Chazal were very intent on linking everything that they put forth back to the Torah, back to precedents. They looked back to those precedents, and everything that they presented was presented as a continuation of things that had been done earlier, or concepts that had been understood earlier, or halachot that had been kept earlier. Okay? That being said, if we look back and we think about Hashem on Har Sinai, and then what we said was the natural extension of Hashem on Har Sinai in the Beit HaMikdash, and we think that the Torah really presents, and Tanakh really, because we go into Malachim, presents Hashem as existing in a specific place and time. We mentioned because Hashem responds and sort of adjusts to the expectations and the needs of people. Then the question has to be, then where did Chazal come up with this concept of centering objects or centering structures within our daily lives? Where did Chazal come up with this idea that within our mundane religious lives we can create these centering structures? So now I will tell you that what I did was unfair because I presented one facet of God in space, really ignoring a second equally important facet of that. And I think that whenever we talk about God and we talk about theology and we talk about Tanakh and Tanakh struggling with the concept of God and trying to make sense of the inscrutable, I think that what we realize implicitly as students of Tanakh is that no human being can ever fully comprehend God. No human being can fully understand what God is or how he interacts with us. And what the words of the Torah as Hashem presented them to us, and what the words of Nach as the various Nevi'im and authors of the various Sifrei Tanakh wrestled with and tried to articulate in the written word at times, was different facets of God that we can make sense of and we can understand. And so, for example, you have
Sefer Yonah, where the Navi is wrestling with the idea that God is too kind and God is too merciful and he forgives people when they don't deserve it. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have the author of Sefer Iyov that's wrestling with how can a seemingly benevolent God do things that seem or strike us as so cruel and unfair. If we look, we're entrenched right now in Sefer Shemot, and so we're dealing with, we're being introduced to a God that, as I mentioned, is Bekerev Haaretz, and a God that will take the rules of nature that he created in Sheish Yemei Bereishit and turn them over on their heads for the sake of his people, for providing for his people, for protecting his people, for making his name known. And then again, on the other end of the spectrum, we read Megillat Esther a couple of weeks ago, where we see very profoundly the Jewish people struggling with and entertaining the question, is God in fact with us in Galut? Do we see him as an optical illusion? Are we in fact thanking God for these events? Is it just coincidence that things worked out the way they did? And so, again, I think that as students of Tanakh, we implicitly understand, or we are okay with, these discordant presentations of God, or these varying presentations of God, because we understand that it's not one versus the other. We're not choosing between Sefer Yonah or Sefer Iyov. What we're really being made aware of, and what the variant Svarim are really tapping into, are these different facets of God. And our job is to take all of these different facets holistically and appreciate as much as we can, again, about that which we will never fully understand. I think that when it comes to divine presence, I think that the same really goes for the way that Hashem is presented in space. I spoke and I said it's unfair because I presented only one way of looking at it. We spoke about Hashem as being located, God appearing in a specific place and of course never being restricted to, but definitely being concentrated in that space. And we spoke about Har Sinai, and we spoke about the Mikdash, and of course the second Beit HaMikdash as well. If you think about it, when B'nai Yisrael were in the Midbar, actually, for 40 years, the Har Sinai happened, but for majority of their experiences in the Midbar, Hashem actually traveled with them. We're told that there was an Amud Anan and an Esh that would travel, and when the Amud Anan or the Esh would stop, B'nai Yisrael knew it was time to camp. And when they would camp, they would build the Mishkan that they had deconstructed for their travels, build a place appropriate for the presence of Hashem, and in that way they would attract and maintain the divine presence for as long as they were there, and then when it was time to go, they would deconstruct it, pack it up, and move again. The Amud Anan and the Esh consistently traveling with them as long as they created a space that was worthy of the divine presence. I think that when we think about history and when we think about people thinking about God in space and how to relate to God, as I mentioned, we have to always be aware that the notion of Dibrat Torah Kilshon B'nei Adam, and there's no question that Hashem was absolutely responding to, again, the associations that ancient Israel had with things like the landscape of the desert and cosmic mountains. But I think that Hashem was also putting forth a very, very important concept by the way that he spoke about his presence as moving literally alongside us in the Midbar, answering the question, Hayesh Hashem Bekirbeinu Ayin, and saying, yes, Hashem does travel along with us. I think for most of our early history, that temple-centric theology, that locative theology eclipsed what Ben Summers actually calls the locomotive theology, the idea that God moves along with us. In the aftermath of Chorban Bayit Sheni, when we were once again struck with feelings of being in the wilderness, of the chaos of Galut, of the unpredictable realities that confronted us, I think that's when Chazal, again in the absence of a temple, looked back and drew to the forefront this, as I mentioned, this locomotive way of understanding God. This idea that Yirmiyahu tapped into for the time being during Galut Bavel, that Chazal really championed, and not only championed, but really cataloged a very specific, clear way of drawing God's presence in, and drawing and really maintaining God's presence in our daily lives. I think that, you know, when I think back to, I mentioned I started out with my reaction and my friend's reactions to the shul, I think that now looking back at what space means, I think that we were lucky, and I think many people in this room, anyone who's sitting in this room weekly, whose the walls are just absorbing Divrei Torah, I think that we are all lucky that in our lives we have places
that are singularly associated with behaviors and actions that Chazal say literally draw the presence of Hashem in our midst. And I would say that, excuse me, perhaps our hope or what we should strive for in our daily lives is to continue to create spaces like that, that in the absence of a temple, to hallow out, carve out spaces in our own lives that are befitting the divine presence and the Shlina of Hashem. And I think if we're able to do that, then we're on the right track. God bless you.